Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Health Committee. It is April Fool's Day, April 1st, 2015. I'm sorry that my committee is not here yet, out there in the wilds. Please come down wherever you are. But I am going to move all over the place right now because I have people that have to be out of here quickly. So I am going to open a public hearing on 661 real quick. Tom Holt, get up here, give your testimony. He's not here. All right. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 558. Sarah Gelser.
And then we'll be moving.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and member of the committee, and Zena. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Albany, Corvallis, Philomath, Millersburg, Tangent, and unincorporated areas of Lynn and Benton County. And Chair Mona Sanderson, I want to know what your trick is to get Senator Cruz to come right at the beginning of the hearing. I'm just teasing.
Madam Chair, we sit next to each other in the committee before your committee, don't we?
We do.
Okay.
Come on, we have a big agenda. Would you please get to your testimony?
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, thank you for scheduling a public hearing on Senate Bill 558. I submitted this bill on behalf of my constituent, Dr. Crowder, who you're going to hear from in a minute, who's with the Corvallis Clinic. And the issue that he discussed with me is that when we have patients that have significant kind of chronic health care conditions, chronic management issues, it's very important for a pharmacist to be able to consult under the direction of a physician with that care team to be able to manage what types of medications are being used, maybe different side effects. This is different than the type of consultation that you might get when you pull through the Rite Aid pharmacy and you initial that they tell you to, you know, take it and eat something at breakfast time or you're not going to feel very good. This is really medical management. Unfortunately, there currently don't exist codes to compensate the pharmacists for doing this that are kind of part of a healthcare system. And if we were to move to a more holistic care model, being able to have pharmacists participate in this way would be particularly helpful for those individuals that do experience chronic care conditions and where there is a lot of specialty knowledge needed around drugs and drug interactions and side effects. Dr. Crowder can explain all of this much better than I can, and I unfortunately have to go to another meeting, but I'm very grateful that you scheduled the bill. I think it's a good idea, and I hope you'll give it your best consideration.
Thank you so much, Senator Gelser. And I will just leave Senate Bill 558 open, and I need to open Senate Bill 874, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I bring another up with me?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I was first introduced to the issue of adrenal insufficiency and the medical protocols that are attendant to this disease by a constituent in Clatsop County. And working with her, we were able to arrange some first responder protocols. Subsequently, I've learned a little bit more about it. I came down today to testify with Jennifer Knapp. She's the executive director of the Adrenal Insufficiency United Group. They have other people here to testify, but for the purpose of expediting your hearing, she's going to make her comments, and then we're going to withdraw. And as time allows, you can hear from her colleagues.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Hello, Senator Manas Anderson and Senate committee members. My name is Jennifer Knapp, and I'm speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 874 in support of that bill. And I have a presentation. I'm not sure how that works.
Did you tell the staff that you had a presentation?
I did.
Okay.
Our staff isn't here to have the presentation.
Oh, sorry.
And how long does it take?
It won't be long. I think I have 5 minutes. Is that okay? Sorry about that.
Questions first.
given the paucity of your time, Madam Chair, and the fact that you have people that I know have to leave, if the technical part of this doesn't happen, would you be willing to allow Ms. Knapp to retire and come back when it's...
Yes, let's have you retire.
Okay.
And then stay there, and then we need to get to 661, and then we will get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to excuse myself and go to my committee.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 661. Zena?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 661 requires health benefit plans that provide coverage of opioid analgesic drug products to provide coverage of abuse deterrent opioid analgesic drug products. There is no amendment, no revenue impact, and no fiscal statements have been issued.
Great. And we have the... All right, David Russo, Matthew McGeehy, and B.J. Kavnor.
Do we have a third? Okay. Chair Mona Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Dr. David Russo. And I'm a board-certified physical medicine rehabilitation pain management specialist in active practice with Columbia Pain Management. Our center is a comprehensive and interventional pain management practice located in the Columbia Gorge, serving a rural catchment area of 70,000 patients across five rural counties. I routinely treat patients with severe intractable pain caused by injuries and diseases such as stroke, spinal cord injury, brain injury, multiple orthopedic traumas, and neuromuscular disorders. In my practice, I also routinely encounter patients with addiction and substance use disorders who seek to obtain narcotic medications for purposes other than legitimate medical use. I'm here to ask your support in passing Senate Bill 661 that would require health benefit plans that cover opioid analgesic drug products to cover abuse deterrent opioid analgesic drug products at no greater cost than other preferred drugs under the plan. Unfortunately, as many of you know, prescription drugs, especially opioid analgesics, used to treat both acute and chronic pain have increasingly been implicated in overdose deaths. From 1999 to 2013, the rate for drug poisoning deaths involving opioid analgesics nearly quadrupled. In Oregon, a state according to a 2014 CDC report for U.S. prescribing ranks fourth for opioid prescribing, in overdose deaths and in toxic overdose and deaths from abuse and misuse. This, in my view, is a problem that's especially prevalent and plaguing smaller, lower-resourced, and rural communities in our state. In fact, according to the Oregon Center for Health Statistics and Vital Records, more Oregonians die from prescription drug overdose than from heroin and cocaine overdose combined. Scientific studies and epidemiological analysis confirm that a portion of these overdose deaths could be prevented or thwarted by the wider use of abuse deterrent formulations of commonly prescribed opioid analgesics. Abuse deterrent formulations make it more difficult for abusers to tamper, crush, manipulate, or manipulate a drug for a purpose that it was not intended. Moreover, prescription of these abuse deterrent formulations in no way negatively impacts the legitimate patient who's prescribed one for a medically indicated purpose. So in summary, abuse deterrent formulations are a key tactic for stemming the tide of overdoses and deaths caused by prescription drug misuse and abuse in our state. Alongside other common sense public policy measures, such as a well-functioning prescription drug monitoring program, enhanced healthcare provider education, awareness, accountability, community-supported drug take-back programs for unused medications, removal of barriers to access overdose reversal medications, and continued support of treatment for addiction and intractable pain, passage of Senate Bill 661 will give healthcare providers like me an indispensable tool to help personalize and tailor medical treatment for patients suffering from intractable pain, reduce risk of unintentional overdose and death from prescription opioid analgesics, and deter the diversion of these medications away from the legitimate medical patient and into our communities and schools. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Dr. Matthew McGeehy. I am a board-certified physical medicine and rehabilitation physician and board-certified in pain medicine as well. I'd like to thank Dr. Russo for his very comprehensive words. I come also today in support of Senate Bill 661 and the opportunity to speak before the committee. I have one disclosure. I am on the Speaker's Education Committee, Speaker's Bureau for Purdue Pharma and for DepoMed Pharma. But I come today as a provider in Oregon. I have a practice, Willamette Pain and Spine Center in West Lynn and in Clackamas. And as Dr. Russo has alluded, much of what we do on a daily basis involves the treatment of patients with chronic pain syndromes. And all of the tools that are necessary to successfully do so should be readily available for our patients. Abuse deterrent formulation medications have been modeled to make it more difficult or dissuade, if you will, patients who have access to opioid medications to abuse said medications. It does not prevent misuse or abuse, but the studies have shown that the changes that happen with abuse deterrent formulations make it considerably more difficult for medications to become in the wrong hands and be diverted. And diversion is where the problem lies, and I think that's something that I think I would like to just also emphasize. Additionally, in my practice of pain medicine, I come across a number of patients who have subjective pain complaints, but then there are changes in the regimen, or they request changes in the regimen, and oftentimes they don't want to fully disclose that something has happened to their prescriptions, or they've been taken from, you know, an older patient who's had a younger family member remove it from their medicine cabinet in the evening time or when that older patient has gone to bed. There are different ways that change the way that the medicine can be diverted or misused. And preventing a medication from being crushed into a powder that can be misused is one of the main things that abuse deterrent medications have in them. The second thing is that you have a counteracting agent that are also incorporated into the tablet and into that same tablet. So when that medication is attempted to be taken in a manner not as intended, it immediately inactivates itself. And these are some of the excessive qualities that are available. Lastly, I just wanted to state that hydrocodone as a whole is the number one prescribed medication in the whole United States of America, including as you look at the most recent pharmaceutical data. And hydrocodone in its traditional formulation is also one of the most diverted medications in the United States of America. So hopefully with measures such as this and the things that we're able to take in consideration, such as this bit of legislature, we'll be able to change some of those patterns. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and I apologize for my tardiness. My name is B.J. Kavnor, for the record, and I am the Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health with the Chronic Healthcare Coalition in Oregon. And today I'm speaking on behalf of us, Caring Ambassadors Program, Cascade AIDS Project, and also on behalf of Central Drug, which is a specialty pharmacy located in Portland. Briefly, you know, what drew us into this was and this is in more detail in my testimony, what drew us to this was the situation in Indiana right now, where we have in Scott County 81 new cases of HIV infection, which are directly attributable to people sharing prescription medication that they're injecting. There's no syringe exchange in place. The medication in question is Opana, which is not to blame the manufacturer of that, but ironically, this medication was itself just reformulated in 2012 to prevent abuse. We're talking about a county of 24,000 people now that have the healthcare burden of treating these additional 81 people with HIV. We're still screening them, or the county is still screening them for viral hepatitis and providing care and services. So let's take a little bit of a look at the numbers briefly. For hepatitis, as you are well aware, we're looking at about $100,000 of a one-time cost of treatment, and that's if we treat and cure. For HIV, on average, we're talking about $24,000 a year in care for the rest of the patient's life. Unfortunately, most of these patients are going to end up on the state's rolls and Medicaid. We know that looking at the abuse numbers that we have, that a disproportionate number of people who live in lower socioeconomic levels are the ones who are using and abusing, more often, let me state, abusing these prescription medications. So In brief, whatever we can do, whatever small measures we can take to prevent people from abusing medication, to teach patients themselves how to better use the medication, to have pain contracts and conversations with providers so that people aren't in pain, people who are living with chronic conditions which cause pain, so that people aren't living in pain, but at the same time, we do whatever we can to reduce the availability of these medications for people to self-medicate and become addicted and abused to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. Despite being a physician, I don't work with patients like this very much. And so I'm really unfamiliar with these ADF drugs, and I'm really confused about how Opana, which we just heard Mr. Kavner say and I've been reading about quickly online, is one of these drugs that's been formulated in this way, is the drug that's the source of abuse in this, you know, the source of this big epidemic of HIV in Indiana. And I'm trying to, I'm agnostic on this, but really trust me on this right now. I'm just trying to really understand, because on the one hand we're saying that these drugs should be covered, on the other hand we're saying that they don't seem to be working quite the way we thought they were going to work in terms of making it really tough to use them in these inappropriate ways. Can you help me understand that a little bit more so that I can wrap my head around this bill a little bit better?
Well, what I could say is, and I'm not a provider, as you all know, but what I can say is, unfortunately, there is no deterrent to addiction and there is no deterrent to abuse. Even with the new medications that are there, people can still take orally a higher dose of them, and you know that would be abusing or misusing the medication. The problem is that with dependency on opiates and addiction, addicts are very good at figuring out how to break through the protections that we put in place. So there's no absolute protection. What we're doing now is we're putting the best steps, the best work forward that we have currently, and hopefully we'll be able to work towards that in the future. You know, we're facing this now with Opana. We faced it in the past with OxyContin. We faced it before that with Vicodin. I mean, this is just the latest drug or formulation of this medication in the latest form.
May I?
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on a couple of different things in terms of the way that the abuse deterrent technologies work from a pharmacological standpoint, and maybe this will answer your question. Some of the newer formulations of medications, we have a parent medication, whatever that medication, you know, opiate of choice, whether it be oxycodone, hydrocodone, whatever the case may be. The medication is delivered through a tablet, and the tablet is significantly resistant to crushing. That's the first avenue that impacts a hardness on the outer tablet, which oftentimes when medications are misused or abused, you can take a ball and peen hammer to it and, sure, and crush it into something that works. The second thing is that the abuse deterrent technology allows the medication, when it's put into a solvent, to not, you know, formulate immediately a liquid, if you will, which is the intravenous side of it too. So if you resist formulation into a liquid, the new technologies form gelatinous bases. The third abuse deterrent technology is the fact that if you try to nasally utilize a medication, they can't be taken through a nasal mucosa, and that basically prevents that avenue. You can still crush it into pieces and ingest it, but then it does not have the same type of pharmaceutical capabilities. The next thing is, if you take a co-activating agent and embed it into the tablet along with the active ingredient, if that were to become taken into an altered state, chewed, crushed, or tried to take it into an avenue which would be taken intravenously, you're immediately exposed to the counteracting agent along with the parent drug, so there is no associated high, if you will.
Right.
Those are the three primary reasons in which abuse deterrent formulations have really come forward in recent times, and those are the measures in which I think it will actually be a deterrent as opposed to a change in terms of how a medication, every medication, you're correct, can be misused or abused.
Sure. I mean, believe me, I've been a doctor long enough to know that. But a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. So, and I'm not trying to pick on Opana either, which is a drug that I'd never even heard of before this outbreak in Indiana. Again, because it's just not in my practice profile. is the issue there that the technologies that are employed with that drug are insufficient, or that the addicts are persistent enough that they're getting around it, or all of the above? And what level of confidence do we have that other formulations better meet the criteria that you've described, Doctor, to help prevent this misuse of these very scary drugs?
Indeed. The question at hand, and it is one where we're trying to stay a step ahead of those who can
It's like hacking. I understand.
Yes.
They're always going to be ahead of us.
You know, I don't know pharmacologically how one kind of goes around if it does have a correct use of it. I know the manufacturers of different medications are trying their best to prevent that. I think the misuse and abuse via intravenous means is the avenue in which most of these are coming into play. And I think the measures that have been drawn up and the way that the technology, if you will, is trying to stay ahead is that there are provisions in place. And that's what the bill really addresses. When you're looking at trying to make available opportunities to provide clinicians like Dr. Russo and myself the opportunity to provide medications we think are better suited for patients who have chronic pain or who have relative risk factors. And having those tools available is a key part of that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Doctor.
Any other questions? Thank you, panel. Tom Holt. And Elise Brown.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Let me just say at the outset two things about this class of products. Number one, they are helpful for a very small percentage of patients who have a history of high-risk drug behavior like intravenous drug use. But this bill is much, much broader than that. It would have us treat these products in terms of cost share exactly the same as all other opioids. The other important point is that opioids as a class is a highly, highly dangerous class of drugs. They have what are called FDA black box warnings on them, which means that they have a very high risk of abuse or diversion. And there is no strong peer-reviewed evidence that the so-called anti-abuse formulations are any safer than any other opioid products. The bulk of the opioid problem is simply a diversion and abuse of all of these drugs, whether they have the anti-abuse formulation or not, from family medicine cabinets. I looked up some information from the prescription drug monitoring program that this body was very wise to initiate and provided that on OLIS, but there's a chart on page 12 of that that shows that in a six-month period, there were 485 opioid prescriptions issued for every 1,000 Oregonians. That's a stunning number. And some other background I provided is an evaluation that just happened to come out from the OSU School of Pharmacy about this class of drugs. And it notes that one really worrisome potential effect of this class of anti-abuse products being in the market is more heroin use, because those who are seeking intravenous drugs can't use these because they aren't convertible easily to they can't be converted to an intravenous form. They can be still broken, and when they're broken, they're even more dangerous than they are in their original labeling because they work faster. And so people get overdosed because they feel the effects more quickly. In terms of pricing in general, this class of drugs runs from 2 to 3 times the cost of a generic product that doesn't have this abuse formulation. About $150 for a 30-day supply of a typical dosage for the generic versus $300 to $500 for a 30-day supply at the same dosage level for these brand name products. And that's, you know, all those reasons are why most health plans have these on very strict supervision protocols. They require prior authorization. They typically are not in a preferred position on formularies because we don't want people to to easily abuse them. For those who do need, because of medical history, the anti-abuse product, we do generally approve that when we're contacted. So what would the bill actually do in the marketplace to cost, and you know, what's it actually do overall? The way we see it, it would force us to treat brand name high cost drugs to be placed at the same out-of-pocket level as the much less expensive generics. And by doing that, what the legislature would be doing is helping the brand name manufacturers gain market share for one of the most dangerous classes of products in the market. So it'd have the effect of increasing the profits for a company like my friends at Pfizer, whose Embedda product was just approved this last fall with the anti-abuse formula, and it has a black box warning. Pfizer's profit level last year was about $9.1 billion on $49.6 billion of revenue net, margin of 18.3%. It seems to us that rather than transferring dollars from our premium payers' pockets to the balance sheets of companies that are wanting to apparently overmarket these drugs if they want something to apply broadly as an even copay, it's the wrong direction to go. We should be making it more difficult to obtain dangerous opioids, not easier. And we should be taking account when we look at policy who is really gaining and who is really losing in this. We think it would be a very bad thing to make it easier to obtain opioids in general. We think these products have a place for a small subset of patients. They do not have a place for everyone who wants one. With that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Elise?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And AHIP does support the national goal of reducing abuse of opioids, at the same time ensuring patients with chronic pain are treated safely. However, this bill does not solve the problem. Tom with Cambia did an excellent job of being thorough. And on behalf of the rest of the AHIP Oregon members, I'm here to also say that we all oppose Senate Bill 661. Two takeaways that I heard in Tom's testimony. Number one, this is precedent setting. So you all should be thinking about, is this really the appropriate venue to be deciding on mandating a specific class of drugs? We know that the FDA has yet to issue official guidance on this. So why would we act now? Senate Bill 661 is going to leave it to manufacturers to make that determination. We don't like that. Number two, and Tom said so well, is that this takes away the utilization management tools that plans do to keep the cost down. So precedent setting, and it's going to raise costs. So, Madam Chair, those are the other two pieces I wanted to add to the testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, panel. All right. This bill needs probably a little bit more work. I don't plan to work session it until this time unless I'm really given some more hardcore evidence that this bill should go forward. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 661, and I want to go to the work sessions to get those out of the way. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 416. Sina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 416 requires smoke shops to pay fees to Oregon Health Authority for certification and renewal every 5 years and for transfer of ownership. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact.
As you remember, we were going to send it to the floor, and then we were going to send it to Finance and Revenue, and now it looks like we have to send it to Joint Committee on Ways and Means, so.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 416 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation that the bill be rescinded from the Finance and Revenue Committee and referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 416 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be rescinded from the Finance and Revenue Committee and be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Motion carries, and it's on its way to Ways and Means. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 416 and open a work session on 757.
Senate Bill 757 appropriates funds for the biennium for the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and Oregon Center for Nursing for data collection analysis to encourage healthcare providers to practice with underserved populations in rural areas. There is no amendment and there is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Hill? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 757. And I would like to open the public hearing on 874, and I think I still have it open. And with that, 874. Who was the first person here? I forget your name. Yes, come, Jennifer, please come forward. And Dr. Ritu Santi and, sorry, Jennifer Knapp, Kirsten Norgaard, and Patricia Bunn.
Hello again, Senator Amanis Anderson and Senate committee members. My name is Jennifer Knapp, and I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 874. I have a presentation here. First, what is adrenal insufficiency? It's a medical condition in which the adrenal glands cannot produce enough glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids to respond to stressors such as illness or injury. Studies indicate that 84,000 Oregonians could have adrenal insufficiency. In an emergency, the body systems of an individual experiencing an adrenal crisis will start to shut down without immediate and proper treatment. Coma, organ failure, cardiac arrest, and death can occur in 30 minutes or less. Recognition and treatment of adrenal insufficiency can reduce mortality by almost 50%. And this is a picture of Scarlett before and after her adrenal crisis. The injection her mother gave her saved her life, but she was left a quadriplegic. This is a pathway that shows what happens in an adrenal crisis. On one side is cortisol, on the other is aldosterone. 75% of those with adrenal insufficiency don't make either of those hormones that are necessary for life. A delay doesn't always mean death, but over 50% of those who do not receive their injection within 30 minutes are admitted to the hospital for one or more days. Some take over a month to fully recover, others become permanently disabled. The treatment for this is a glucocorticoid and mineral corticoid must be administered. Hydrocortisone is the drug of choice because it has both of those properties. The injection starts working within 15 minutes, so the sooner it's given, the better the patient will be able to recover. We have letters of support written by several endocrinologists to back that up. And how will it be identified? Emergency personnel should look for IDs, listen to the patient, family members, or friends. Magnets, car decals, and other stickers are used. And since the most common cause of secondary adrenal insufficiency is prior steroid use, all patients should be asked if they are taking steroids. If the drug is given to someone in error, it will do no harm. It is the bioequivalent to cortisol, a hormone the body makes naturally. And again, we have letters in support to back this up. Why should training be required? We conducted a survey of over 250 individuals with adrenal insufficiency. The results showed that an injection or IV to treat an adrenal crisis has been needed one or more times by 75% of those with adrenal insufficiency. In 75% of those cases, first responders had no knowledge of adrenal insufficiency. In 50% of the visits to the ER, physicians and nurses had no knowledge of adrenal insufficiency. The injection or IV was given within 30 minutes on only 12% of the reported cases. Again, secondary adrenal insufficiency has been demonstrated in 31% of patients admitted to a critical care unit, so it's a lot more common than we think. Training can save lives. In Durham County, North Carolina, 7 cases of adrenal insufficiency have been identified and treated since training events were first held in October. The fiscal impact, I think, is great. The cost of one vial of Solu-Cortef is $10. The number of ambulances in Oregon, both air and ground, are 614. Looks like that got cut off. So the initial cost of the Solu-Cortef to equip every emergency vehicle in the state of Oregon is only $6,140. The cost to develop training for EMS and ER personnel is free. Our organization has contracted with the National College of Technical Instruction, and the training has been completed, and it will be free to all those who need it. It addresses all the issues stated in the bill. A day spent as an inpatient at an American hospital costs on average $4,287. The most expensive hospitals charge more than $12,000 a day. In our survey of over 250 individuals, 50% of those given the injection did not need to spend more than 12 hours in the hospital. Giving the injection saves lives and money. These states and regions have protocols for their citizens with adrenal insufficiency to keep them safe. What's Oregon's excuse not to join them? And you'll notice Oregon, Clatsop County, is the only county in Oregon that has protocols right now in both their EMS and their ERs. And then that's just references. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go through the panel, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson and committee members and senators. My name is Kirsten Norgaard, and I am the mother of Tristan Norgaard and Faith Norgaard right here. Tristan has adrenal insufficiency, and we have been working for this since, well, he's almost 7, so it's been a while. This is actually what the vial of Solu-Cortef looks like. If any of you would like to see it, I'm happy to bring it up. The only place in Oregon, as you can see, is where we're from. We live in Astoria, and with the help of Betsy Johnson and our EMS director and the ER, everyone was very willing and able to work with us. It might be because we're a small town and we look after each other, but whatever it was, it worked. We do have protocols at our ER. But it took a half a dozen ER nightmares to before it was realized. We would have to take Tristan in, lifeless. He was hallucinating a few times, not even aware of where he was. And, you know, the doctor's telling me that he wants to do a chest x-ray on my son who's dying. I mean, he's literally dying. And I had all the information for them. And I'm getting off track, and I apologize.
You're doing fine. Thank you.
But we've been trying for so long to get this done, and I feel like his life is worth more than just a $10 shot. And I just beg you to please help us, because we've tried every... Thank you very much. We've tried every avenue. That we know, we've gone to the EMS conferences, and we've called, and we've emailed, and we've sent packets, and we've done fundraisers, and we've tried everything. And right now, I'm just laying it at your feet, and just please help us. Please help my son. His life is worth so much more. And I don't want my daughter to worry about her brother dying, because she does.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I'm Patricia Bunn, and I'm just here to support. I really wasn't planning to talk, but I can give a little history. Our granddaughter lives in Salem. She was born with congenital adrenal insufficiency, hyperplasia. She's been to the ER several times. The doctors really were not aware of this, and at one point my daughter was written up as Munchausen by proxy syndrome because she brought her to the emergency room too many times. So if they have this available, it can be, people are more aware of what the situation is, and they can be treated urgently.
Thank you. And it is so important for people like you to come forward, because this is how we can get change in the system. So you don't know how valuable it is for your visit to come here and for this bill to be brought forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
Comments?
Chair.
Yes, Senator
Shields. Ms. Knapp, was your presentation submitted to the professional staff? Because
it is. Thank you.
I didn't see it on
should
the whole
be.
List. Do you? Okay. All right, good. Because
there was a glitch. So.
Okay. It will be on OLIS, though. Thank you very much. With that, I would like to call up Gerald Bunn, Paula Rivas, and Lillian Street.
Hi there. I'm Paula Rivas Street, and I am Miss Lillian Street's mother. Go ahead, Buck.
Hello, I am Lillian Street, and I am 12 years old, and I have adrenal insufficiency, and these are my friends.
I came today just to talk, and I totally can... I feel for Kirsten because I have been there, too. We live in Oregon City, so we live in Clackamas County. As a mother, I've had to call Clackamas County, the head of the EMS, who put me off for a little while, and then he did some information checking, and then he's like, wow, this is a big deal. And so he contacted his higher-ups at OHSU and at our local hospital, Willamette Falls Hospital in Oregon City, and now... Miss Lillian is on their register. So if her name is on a call in Clackamas County, then they know how to respond for her at school and at her home. But that only works for us in Clackamas County. I don't know about you, but like right now, we're not in our county. We're in Marion County, I do believe. And it frightens me. As a mom driving, our car is tagged with this symbol right here for adrenal insufficiency. She's tagged with medical alert, and she has a bracelet on, and she has a car seat thing, not car seat, sorry, plug, but on her strap, she has an alert there. And then I carry this in my purse. This is my Soliocortef for her, all in one little thing. It's in my purse. But if we get in a crash anywhere besides Clackamas County, is that going to help me? Or more so, is it going to help her? The answer is probably not. When we go to different things like healthcare days, for example, the Winterhawks had a healthcare thing just last weekend. And I hand out Adrenal Insufficiency United's little cards to their paramedics or to their firefighters that they have there. Because I asked them, you know, hey, do you know anything about adrenal insufficiency? And they're like, no, we don't. We have no idea. And then when I tell them her story, because she has something different, she has panhypopituitarism, which basically is her pituitary does not work. They are really interested in it. And as a teacher, and I know that other healthcare providers and other people who work with the public, we want to help people. That is why we chose that. And I know that EMS and they're there to help. And if they saw her in a crisis, they would want to know how to help her. So we ask you to please support Senate Bill 874, please.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Lillian, for coming and so that we can really see you and for bringing your son, too, Justin. And your daughter.
Can I ask a really quick question, Madam Chair? I'm really struck by what you said about Lillian now being on a Clackamas registry. And it occurs to me that we have registries in this state for things like for people toward the end of life, the physician order for life-sustaining treatment, and people can have things in their handbags or whatever that say that they're part of this statewide registry. Do you know if any states have done anything like that for adrenal insufficiency, where there's a statewide registry for people so that paramedics could easily identify if someone was wearing a bracelet or something, they could check the registry to confirm that? If you don't, it's not a big deal, but maybe somebody could get back to us. Jennifer?
I'm not sure if there is.
Okay, come to the...
You have to speak
on the
record. It's just an interesting...
And state your name for the record again.
Jennifer Knapp. I'm not sure about a registry. I know at one of the EMS conferences I was out, they spoke about something like that, and that would help for those that were identified with adrenal insufficiency, but like in Durham, North Carolina, those seven people that were identified because the EMTs and the ER nurses had received that training.
Okay. So they were new diagnoses.
Yeah, it would help for a certain part of the population, but for those people that are presenting at the emergency room, if the training's not in place there, then it wouldn't necessarily help them.
Okay.
But I think it would be a great idea for those that are identified.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Gerald Bunn and Carinza Summers.
Can she come sit with me? Sure. Sure. Sorry, I shouldn't have said anything. It's the chair's prerogative. Sorry.
I'm used to it.
Oh, man. Should I just leave now?
No, not at all.
Hello, Senator Moniz, Anderson, and Senator Committee Meeters. Meeting, huh? I can't even speak. I'm sorry. I'm nervous. I'm speaking in support of SB 874. My name is Carinza Summers. I have adrenal insufficiency, and so does Aubrey Morales right here, her daughter. I do not produce cortisol. I, like them, I carry my own injection. If something were to happen, I have a 15-year-old at home that would have to inject me because there is no protocol. My mom is a registered nurse, but she lives across town. So if I needed help, my son is very well educated on what he needs to do to give me this injection. Thank goodness he's never had to. Took me about 6-7 years to be diagnosed. When I was finally diagnosed, my GP told me that it was very rare and it was very detrimental to be on daily steroids every day, and he took me off of them. Within 12 hours, I was in the emergency room. I was lethargic. My vitals were slipping. I had a migraine. I could not sit up. I had no color. I was basically dying. My mother, as I said, is a surgical nurse. We went into the hospital that she works in. The doctor that was on call did not have any recollection. He had no idea what adrenal insufficiency was. So my mother and the ER nurse discussed the fact that I needed 100 milligrams of Solu-Cortef. I needed IV fluids, and I needed Zofran to stop the nausea, because once you're sick as an adrenal patient, it can slip you further into crisis if you throw up just one time. So they had a trauma triage that came in. It was a car accident, and he basically said, give her what she needs, and he left the room. He said, we'll be back to check on her. So the nurse then proceeded to give me my IV. She gave me the Solu-Cortef, the Zofran, and she said she'd be back because she had to go check on the triage. They came back in the room within 25, 30 minutes later. I was sitting up. My blood pressure was rising. My body temperature was coming back to normal. I could speak, and if it wasn't for that, I probably would have died. But thank goodness they listened to my mom, and they gave me the attention that I needed. And then about 2 months later, the nurse that helped came back to my mother and said, because of the experience that I had, she had gone up to OHSU, and she had also been diagnosed with a growth hormone deficiency and was also placed on steroid medication and growth hormone medication because of my steroid or because of my experience. So basically my point is awareness is key. Protocol saves lives. And thank you so much for listening to us.
Well, thank you so much for bringing your story to us and making us aware of this extremely important issue. Is there comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call Dr. Ritu Santi, Katie King, Will Brusher.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, excuse me, I'm just getting over something here. But for the record, my name is Dr. Ritu Sani. I am a practicing emergency physician and EMS physician in the Portland metropolitan area. I speak today on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of EMS Physicians. Also, just as point of information, I'm the past president of the National Association of EMS Physicians and the former state EMS and trauma medical director for the state of Oregon. I'm addressing you today in opposition of Senate Bill 874. Our chapter of the NAMSP is against Senate Bill 874 because it squarely puts the legislature in the business of practicing medicine. The bill doesn't simply require education. It puts requirements in place as to what protocols and medications ambulances should carry and what protocols physicians should write. The practice of EMS medicine is regulated by the Oregon Health Authority as well as the Oregon Medical Board, and that practice is not regulated by statute. Or, well, it is, but I mean, there's not specific statute around individual disease processes. If this bill were to pass, this would be the first disease process or emergency process that had its own set of statutes. And we don't have legislation around cardiac arrest or stroke or how we take care of all of those incredibly dangerous and important conditions. I also think that, you know, given all that, if this bill really made a huge impact, I would still be supportive. As an EMS person, my job is to take care of the health of the people around me and in my community. And I really strongly believe that the best way for that to occur is by the patients having clear self-identification and working closely with EMS in their community. Those of us who are here representing EMS all have examples of patients with adrenal insufficiency in our communities. We work very closely with them and their families to make sure that they are have proper protocols in place around them and are well identified. And then finally, we want to empathize with patients and their families, and we do want to pledge moving forward to work with them as closely as possible to ensure that all of our community is safe.
Thank you. Let's hear the panel first.
There you go. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Will Bowser. I'm a director with the EMS section of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I also am a local agency EMS division chief and a practicing licensed paramedic. I'm here also in opposition of this bill, predominantly not for the concern around patient safety. We're all very well aware of the concerns here and empathize and would agree with the concerns around patient safety. However, when we start legislating issues around mandated education, protocols and pharmaceuticals, we start running into some challenges. From the standpoint of cost for an agency, training can be free, but the labor costs associated are still ever present with mandated training, especially with a heavily represented workforce. So while the training is free, the cost to deliver or mandating that requires frequently overtime and cost to a local institution. From that standpoint, though, if I may, the education is already well established in the national educational standards for paramedic at a national level and has been in place for over 4 years. From a standpoint of protocols, I just would like to kind of share a couple of personal stories. In my own jurisdiction, we've added and ensured that we've addressed this particular indication. We do carry selumetrol, similar medication, and we have that adrenal insufficiency, adrenal crisis as an indication for basically Linn and Benton counties, so the Mid-Willamette Valley. The other thing that I've had personal involvement with is in the second largest school district in the state, helping to coordinate a protocol within that school district and their local EMS to address this concern in a school setting with their school nursing staff, as well as in our own district in Corvallis. From the standpoint of medication, again, when we start mandating specific medications, it kind of takes away some of our flexibility. I have a certain amount of room in the ambulance to be able to stock pharmaceuticals and maintain their supply. And when we start mandating the specifics, it takes some challenges, and infrequently I'm unable to utilize medications for multiple purposes versus a single use. And with that, I'll turn it over to Katie.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And I do want to say that I had an opportunity to meet with Ms. Knapp during the interim and appreciate the work that they've done around public awareness efforts. However, OSEP opposes this bill because it seeks to codify medical evaluation and treatment in statute. And just for the reasons that the previous speakers have outlined, emergency physicians feel that they need to have the flexibility to do a medical evaluation and put the best interest of the patient first instead of adhering to a protocol that's in statute. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, Dr. Sani here will answer them.
All that extra school, this is what I get.
Well, obviously there needs to be more training from the stories that we just heard from the patients. So I would agree with you that we shouldn't codify, you know, standards in statute. But I'd like to make this bill better, so I would like to have some constructive brainstorming on how to change this bill, whether it's to direct you to, I don't know, you are the ones who would have to figure out how to make sure that all ERs and all EMSs are trained and know about this, because I'm convinced that there is a problem.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the stories notwithstanding, the treatment of adrenal insufficiency that is part of the medical school curriculum. I mean, I first learned about it as a first year student when I learned about physiology of the adrenal gland. You know, I recently recertified my PALS because as an emergency physician, I have to keep my PALS. And in the standard PALS certificate is, you know, if somebody is not responsive to fluids, consider adrenal insufficiency. I'm completely willing to work with whoever to make training available, to improve training, and these folks definitely need to be commended for their creating awareness. And we're supportive of the ultimate goal of all of our patients getting better care. So, you know, I think in general, I can support those concepts. But the training is sprinkled throughout. And, you know, for me as an emergency physician, I mean, I'm taught day one, somebody is hypotensive and not responding to resuscitation, that I should strongly consider steroids for the use.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I hear you loud and clear, and you're on the front lines in emergency medicine, both of you, and the people you represent, Ms. King, are as well. I guess I would remind both of you of the adage, common things are common and rare things are rare, which is to say that, you know, adrenal insufficiency, while certainly not uncommon, is not particularly common either. And when you have a paramedic out in the field, I actually asked my husband about this because he was a paramedic for 20 years and an emergency department nurse for 8 after that. So he has a certain amount of frontline experience. And he, to the best of his recollection, almost never saw somebody with this. And so I think it's important to bear in mind that while, yes, we have to do these recertifications and remember we get reminded about things like this in these advanced life support courses. That's not necessarily true in every emergency department across the state. We have large ones where they see a lot of diverse things, and we have small ones where they may have somebody like the family from Clackamas visiting out in John Day, and that's a lovely hospital out there. I've practiced out there, but I bet you they don't see a lot of people with adrenal insufficiency on a regular basis, and to expect them to remember that if it hasn't been brought to their attention recently. I will say, personally, and I know this is more of a speech than a question, but I think it's important to get this on the record, I find myself in a really tough position right now. I have historically vigorously opposed the legislature mandating any medical education, continuing education for healthcare professionals, in fact, in general, because I think it's really problematic and it doesn't apply to everybody. I certainly am not necessarily supportive of mandating a specific protocol. That I don't agree on. But I do think that we clearly have a gap here, and that as more people live longer with certain chronic illnesses, it's not just kids who are born with adrenal insufficiency or develop panhypopituitarism or have similar episodes. It's people who are on chronic steroids for COPD or anything like that. So I'm with my chair. I'd like you to work productively with the advocates to think about whether there's some kind of a middle ground here, because this is one of the rare times I'm going to be interested in making an exception to my I don't like to mandate continuing education rule. Because I do think we've got a real risk here, and we should be training people to be cognizant of it, to be aware of it, to have those protocols in place, and be thinking about it hard. I don't think this is a bill that I can vote yes on in its current form, but I think it's a bill I'm very interested in seeing moving forward. Its companion bill, 875, is much more narrowly tailored. That's in the education context, but that's only for our kids who are in K-12, and it doesn't help adults when they become ill and they're dealing with this. So I just would urge you to take that piece seriously. As somebody who is a practicing physician, who trains physicians, it's just not something we see on a regular basis. You could get somebody in my primary care practice coming in with adrenal insufficiency, and it's just not something that would immediately spring to mind when somebody comes in with the symptoms that, yes, I should be able to recognize, I probably can, but if I haven't seen it in a while, it may not be the first thing that springs to mind. Migraine's a lot more common.
Oh. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I was just thinking, too, as my wife is a nurse practitioner in private practice, and maybe there's a whole other realm of people who need to be educated on this beyond just the EMTs and emergency physicians. But I think we just need to think broader and outside the box about how we address their problem. It might not be in way that this bill is written, but maybe you can help us figure out something that helps.
Okay, so I'm not sure who's going to coordinate this. We have still Patty O'Sullivan, but we'll have Katie sort of look at language, working with Jennifer to try to see what we can salvage from this bill that, you know, it won't be necessarily exactly what they want, but it is reasonable implementation or something from your standpoint. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, during our conversations over the interim, we did discuss ways that we could move forward without a bill. And one of those components was a public education piece. And I believe that there were discussions about using the EMS conference as a venue to help increase awareness for professionals. And I think that there were also some other ideas in the mix. It's also my understanding that Senator Prozansky was going to convene a meeting with stakeholders to talk more about ideas moving forward. Thank you.
Okay, let's have Patty O'Sullivan come, and then
good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm here today with two hats on. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm pretty sure you can all predict what my testimony will be for that, and I won't disappoint. But I'm also here as a parent. I'm going to testify as a parent first. you know, we all know each other, but we don't really know each other. And I have four kids. I don't know if anybody ever knew that. My kids are grown, and I have three daughters and a son. And my third child, Kimberly, is 44. And she has something called Addison's disease. And it is a an adrenal insufficiency disease brought on as an adult. So these are all kids who, they don't have Addison's to my knowledge, but Kim has Addison's and it has the same effect, except she has no adrenal glands at all. Theirs aren't working, or their pituitary aren't working. She has none. She was born with them, but they went away. It's like the bad cells ate the good cells. I'm not a medical person, so that's my description of it.
It works.
Mm-hmm. At the time Kim's symptoms became very, very serious, she was actually living in France for a couple of years. She's sort of my world traveler, and she was over there, and they have socialized medicine. She went to a number of different doctors, wondering why she had these splotches all over her face and why she was so tired and her back ached and all this stuff. And they said they sent her to a dermatologist and did some other things, none of which helped her. She finally decided she needed to come home. And when she was a healthy 25, 26-year-old when she got off the airplane in a wheelchair. And coming back from France, they had had a layover in Chicago, and they had to take her to the little Chicago airport hospital and give her an IV. And, I mean, we were horrified. She said she didn't feel good, but, you know, whatever. And so she kind of laid around my house for a couple weeks, and as a good mom should, I'm kind of like, come on, let's get up. We got to go find that job now, you know, get some extra sleep tonight. You can't just lay there because you're not in France anymore, and which I feel horrible about today and apologize profusely to her. But as it turned out, she went to one of my other daughter's houses and to stay for a weekend, and my daughter had to bring her to the emergency room. She had to carry her into the emergency room. And she had a blood pressure of 50 over 30. She was almost dead. This is very, very serious. These people can die very, very quickly. And she had not been diagnosed. She went to Willamette Falls Hospital in Oregon City, which is a sort of out-of-the-way hospital. However, there was a very astute emergency room doctor, a female, who couldn't figure out what she had, because the regular panel of tests will not tell you that. It's a combination of tests that you have to do to find somebody that has Addison's disease. She happened to call a doctor friend of hers and said, this is what she's presenting with. They also present with all the lines on your hands are black. Okay, they're very, very dark. Her face was completely splotched. These are very, very typical onset as adult Addison's disease symptoms. And that doctor said, do these two tests. They did them, and Kim was diagnosed. In the meantime, though, it took a day and a half to diagnose her because the tests take a while, but they thought she had Addison, so they immediately gave her, and these guys could probably help me, cortisol. It's not that I don't love her and care about this, I just... so they immediately gave it to her in her IV anyway, just in case. And so she got better. So she was actually in the hospital for 5 days in intensive care and then released. This is 20 years later. She's now 44, and she's still taking her cortisol every day, which will end up probably destroying some organs of hers eventually, but she knows it's the way she can live. She wears a bracelet. She has been in and out of the ED the first 10 years she had it many times. Every time she had the flu, every time she had a bad cold, she ended up in the ED. But at that time she was not, and this is nothing about these kids. This is, I'm talking about one person. She wasn't taking care of herself then, and now she does. And for the last 10 years, she's not had to make a visit because she eats very healthy, she exercises all the time, and she stopped drinking and doing all the things that were bad for her. So that's my parent hat. I know what is needed here, and I also understand your need to have some sort of education, maybe not formal training, but, and I'll be glad to meet with Katie and everybody and talk about how we can maybe do something. Maybe the association can help with that. But now I'm going to testify as the lobbyist for the hospitals, and we oppose this bill, and I'm sure you knew that. And a couple of things that really hit me, and the other witnesses talked about not having a protocol in law. And but the one that kind of hit me, and I showed Kim this bill. We went to coffee, and I said, she couldn't get off work. She's an acupuncturist, actually. But I showed her this bill, and she was a little bit horrified about the a protocol to prioritize the treatment of a patient who has adrenal insufficiency. And she said, I don't believe I'm any more important than somebody coming in with a heart attack that's going to die. And I would really hate to see a protocol that prioritizes patients and tells a hospital who to see first. I have faith that they know who is the sickest and who should be seen. So with that, I'll just close out. You're welcome to ask me any questions, probably more about me than you ever wanted to know. But nevertheless, sometimes things hit us lobbyists in our hearts as well as in our heads. And so I just thought it was important that as this goes on and we look at some amendments that you know that I will have in mind my daughter and the fact that she was that close to death. Thank you.
Could you then work with Katie and Jennifer? Maybe you and Katie work first to come up with some ideas, share them with Jennifer and see if we can make this bill better, or at least so that you feel not completely comfortable, but we'll move a little bit toward what they need.
Senator Mona Sanderson, I will commit to work with them to either make the bill better or get actual promises from entities that they will either do training or create some a pamphlet or something. And I will I can't commit that we'll do this, but I'm going to ask my association if we will send material to every ED in this state. And there's 62 hospitals that I represent. So,
okay.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming and telling your story. And this bill is going to have something in it. We're not quite sure what right now. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing of Senate Bill 874 and open. Is Senator Brett Dembro here?
If not,
okay, I will go ahead and open Senate Bill 558. Yeah. So, and we already had Senator Gelser. And Zena, do you want to explain the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 558 requires that health benefit plans reimburse the cost of consultation with a patient or physician if the pharmacist.
Oh, there's Senator Brent Dembro. Can we allow him to testify? Then we'll. I'm sorry. But you can just stay seated there. We'll at least let Senator Dembro. No, you can stay seated.
I just gotta get up some.
Okay, all right.
Thank you.
Zena, do you want to describe? I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 705.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 705 requires the Oregon Health Authority to study and make a report on the demolition of residential structures painted with lead-based paint or insulated with asbestos. It requires the submission of a report to the Interim Committee of the Legislative Assembly and declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Senator Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the state senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. This bill comes to you as a result of concerns that a lot of members of my district have expressed to me. And what it has to do with is a practice that is becoming more and more common in the city of Portland and probably in other parts of the state as well, where existing houses are being demolished and replaced with, either multifamily dwellings or just you know, in many cases, larger houses on the same footprint. And, you know, in my monthly constituent coffees, people will very frequently come and complain about that practice and the impact that it's having on their neighborhood. Now, that is really an issue for the city of Portland, and the city of Portland is, I think, addressing it. What really resonated with me in their concerns was the sort of the health impacts when those homes come down, and the impact of, you know, the dust of debris that is in those homes, which very often will contain lead paint or asbestos, or you know, other kinds of insulation. And so in seeing what I could do about that, you know, I learned that the Oregon Health Authority and the Construction Contractors Board don't have regulatory authority over this type of situation. And, you know, it became clear to me that we need to really explore this issue. And so what this bill does is it directs the Oregon Health Authority to study and make a report on the demolition of residential structures that have been painted with lead-based paint or that have been insulated with asbestos. And it directs the authority to study the risks to public health and strategies for mitigating those risks when these homes come down in the middle of crowded neighborhoods. So that, in a nutshell, is the purpose of this bill, so that we can look to see, do we need regulations for lead paint dust as well as asbestos airborne particles when an entire house is demolished. So that's the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions about it.
Okay.
I think there will be people here who can speak to the issue as well.
I wanted to make sure you were able to testify, and we'll go back to another bill. And
right.
I do have specific questions on this, but I'll wait to ask.
Okay, I have to go back to my committee.
Yes, okay.
Thank you,
Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you for your time.
All right. We still will keep 705 open, but let's continue with 558.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Terry Crowder. I'm the pharmacy manager at the Corvallis Clinic in Corvallis, Oregon. Today, I represent the administration, physicians, and surgeons of the clinic in stating that we support Senate Bill 558, which is sponsored by our Senator Gelzer. The Corvallis Clinic is a patient-centered primary care medical home, which is a type of integrated health care delivery system. Many of our patients in the clinic have chronic diseases and often require many medications for proper treatment. To address these many issues that can come with the use of multiple medications and to help our patients reach their highest level of wellness, the clinic wants to have a pharmacist on our interprofessional healthcare team that is described similarly in Section 3502 of the Affordable Care Act. However, since the pharmacist remains one of the healthcare professionals in our clinic who can't bill health benefit plans for patient encounter, for business reasons, the clinic can't afford to have anyone on the team who can't directly contribute financially to production. Considering this, the purpose of Senate Bill 558 is to require health benefit plans to provide reimbursement for pharmacist patient encounters when the pharmacist is working for an integrated healthcare delivery system and is practicing in the clinic under a collaborative drug therapy management agreement made with physicians of the clinic. Passage of Senate Bill 558 will provide the ability for the pharmacist to be included on our clinic healthcare team and allow the most integrated, comprehensive, and highest quality care possible for our patients. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Charlene Yeager. I'm a registered nurse at the Corvallis Clinic and Director of Clinical Services. I'm here today to represent the Corvallis Clinic in support of Senate Bill 558. Pharmacists have trained at least 6 years, and some as many as 8, which I feel prepares them for more than repackaging and dispensing pills. A pharmacist's ability to identify, resolve, manage and prevent medication-related issues, help patients avoid preventable medication-related hospitalizations and ER visits, complements the skills of other healthcare professionals within our organization. Unfortunately, pharmacists currently lack provider status, and in the absence of a reimbursement model, we are unable to fully integrate them and benefit from their expertise and training. Given more legal acknowledgement and expanded rights to work on the behalf of patients, pharmacists could share in improving patient care and controlling escalating healthcare costs. Some examples are in care coordination, pharmacists could help manage medication therapy for high-cost, medically complex patients. There is great value in having pharmacists involved in disease state management programs such as diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, congestive heart failure, hypertension, and depression. In our anticoagulation clinic, pharmacists could help improve the safety and efficiency of anticoagulant treatment. They could improve adherence to medication and diet management, thus reducing anticoagulant-related hospitalizations. In our oncology and infusion services, they could help manage costly medication inventory, ensure safer medication prescribing, screen and prevent potential drug interactivity, and provide medication therapy management recommendations to providers. In pain management, they could provide consultative support to prescribing providers by helping providers safely and effectively prescribe controlled substances towards the goal of reducing prescription drug abuse. Without integrating pharmacists within the community health team, we are hindered in our ability to deliver what the patient-centered medical home model promises. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Thank you. And I am aware that House Bill 2028 addresses the same issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2028 is more directed toward what we would consider a traditional community pharmacy setting, in that way we'd be talking about like your Walgreens, Walmart, your independent stores. The clinic setting is more dynamic, quite a bit different. Our concern is that if we are grouped together with that, we would lose some of the richness of our environment. Some of House Bill 2028, I've seen a draft, so I'm not sure that I've seen the most current, is still fairly product-driven, and it is not really descriptive of what we do. The differences, it doesn't reflect the differences in the work.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Holt and Bill Cross.
Chair Mo Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt. Bill Cross had to leave. He had a schedule conflict. We're here in opposition to 558, but not because we're opposed to the idea of pharmacists getting paid to provide a higher level of service. In fact, we do pay them for the kind of services that were just described in a clinic setting for things like anticoagulation management. In the clinic I go to, I see a pharmacist at least once a month, and they get paid for that at a clinic level. Specialty drug management, oncology pharmacy, substance abuse recovery centers. There are pharmacists who work with them, and they get paid through the center as well. There are a number of environments where, with appropriate protocols in place and clear demonstrable value in achieving better outcomes for patients, we do pay. We have been working with Mr. Cross on House Bill 2028. We're supportive of that bill because it would bring some uniformity of approach to the use of protocols in community pharmacies, but also in health system settings. Under that bill, it would be possible for even public health to engage in some protocols. So there, it's quite far-reaching, and we're very pleased with the progress that's been made. And I think at this point on 2028 on the House side, we're just waiting for the amendments to come back, and everybody's in agreement to move forward. And our preference is to work on that vehicle for advancing this. As an organization, we have felt for some time that pharmacists are greatly underutilized relative to their training and their license level. If we want people to be practicing at the top of their license, the House bill is the kind of thing that we should be doing, and hopefully you will be seeing it very soon in your committee.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marion Blankenship. I am the Director of Government Relations with Pacific Source. We have also been working with
But I asked the conversation to be taken out to the hallway. Thank you.
We've been working with the good Representative Kenny Geyer and Bill Cross and other stakeholders on House Bill 2028. And I would just share that our pharmacy director is absolutely passionate about clinical pharmacy services. And this has been an area of evolving sort of work for Pacific Source over the last 5 years. And we have been fairly active in engaging the use of clinical pharmacy, in particular with high-risk patients, but we are absolutely in support of the value that's brought through and by pharmacists. So very supportive of House Bill 2028. We think that it actually does a nice job of defining what clinical pharmacy services are. It outlines sort of the clinical pharmacy services agreement that would help establish the protocol between physicians and pharmacists. It expands sort of the protocol approach, and then it ultimately allows payment for service. So we think that it really does achieve much of what you, the previous panel spoke to. We think it's a really good vehicle and hope that you'll get to see it soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if I could add, if I wasn't completely clear, I did have a short conversation with Mr. Cross before he had to leave. He wanted me to make sure that you knew that he also supported the idea of focusing on the House bill.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on 558, and let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 705, and John Sandy and Sharon Genasi. Lena, I think you already gave us. Okay.
Sharon is just coming back into the room.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair and fellow members of the committee, thank you for letting us speak to you today. My name is John Sandy. I am here representing the United Neighbors Neighborhoods for Reform, which is a grassroots group in Portland, Oregon that was prompted to come into being based on Senator Dembrough's discussion about the epidemic of housing demolitions occurring in certain neighborhoods in Portland. I'd like to relate a little bit about how I got to this chair today. Last summer, I was working with a group of citizens with the Bureau of Development Services in Portland dealing with the housing demolitions. And we were working on better notification of neighbors, extended waiting periods. And during the course of that meeting with lots of city employees, developers, and other interested neighbors, I had the opportunity to ask the question. I said, who does the mother of children living next to a demolition call to make sure that it's safe for her kids to go out and play? And just like this silence, there was a long period of silence. And I thought for a minute, and I voiced what other people were thinking after that long silence. I said, this is a problem. So that started me on the journey. That's why I'm sitting in this chair. That prompted myself and many others in our organization, UNR, to do some research into the housing demolitions and who actually, rules and regulation, who is actually responsible for dealing with these. And after that, many of us were disappointed and surprised at the inefficient patchwork of all the agencies that have a little finger in the pie, DEQ, OHA, EPA, the CCC, the board, and actually OSHA. When you start looking at those, they're totally inefficient. Everybody has a little piece, but together they don't handle the situation very well. In the past 3 years, Portland has had over 750 demolitions. Many of those houses are pre-1950, so you know that asbestos and lead is present in them. I'm not going to talk about all the dangers of asbestos and lead this committee, but I would like to point out a couple things. Both the EPA and the CDC have indicated there is no emphasis, no safe level of lead or asbestos. You can't take somebody that's been exposed and take them out to fresh air and and give them fresh air so they can relieve the systems. You can't take them down to an ER and get a shot of adrenaline to counteract the impacts. If they're exposed, there is a potential for irreversible long-term health impacts. So we have to remember that. There's no second chance in this one. There's no going back to try to fix it. Once it happens, that's it. The potential is there for long-term health issues. Well, the Bill 7, SB 705, charges the OHA to do a study on the impacts during house demolitions of, in this particular case, lead and asbestos. There's other bad actors that could be in play, but let's focus on those. I submit that there already is good scientific studies to show the negative impacts during housing. I'd like to reference a few of those right now. One is the HUD study by the UFC, University of Illinois in Chicago, for housing demolitions in Chicago. And that study resulted in a couple key findings that I want to relate to the committee. That is that there is significant amounts of lead dust emitted during older house demolitions. They've proven that. They measured it, and often in excess of established limits. The improvement of dust suppression techniques is needed to minimize this lead dust. And the lead dust fall was detected at distances 300 feet from the perimeter of the demolition. And there was a further study, and all this is the references study that I have references in my testimony. There was a further study by Wayne State University and a commuter model that even indicated that the spread of this dust is much farther than 300 feet. Well, the EPA and the designate, and their designate in Oregon, the OHA, have broad and detailed procedures relative to renovation, painting, and retrofitting of a house. They are totally silent on whole house demolitions, which, if you look at the prerequisites for kicking in these very detailed requirements as 6 square feet of disturbing, that's like taking down a door frame in your house. That kicks in these, but they are silent on a whole house demonstration, which makes no common sense to me at all. I don't understand that. The HUD study that I mentioned before was also predicated by an East Baltimore study. And this was a study that established some simple and practical means to mitigate this potential, this lead dust and asbestos and other bad actors during demolition. And I picked a couple of them. And again, my background is engineering. I'm practical, pragmatic, so I'll go for the simple things first. One of them is obviously perform deconstruction of the elements of the house that carry the high concentration of lead. That's the trim, the windows, the doors, the trim. Deconstruct that. Pull that out before you take the backhoe to it and crush the house. That obviously makes sense to me as a good step to mitigate the potential for risk. Provide adequate wetting. Another one, just dust suppression. These are pretty simple and easy things to do. Daily cleanups, don't leave it there to be tracked in the neighborhood. And clearly communicate these efforts to the neighbor so they're not living in fear and don't understand things. A couple other quick things. Tacky mats by the door so you don't bring the problem from outside and bring it into the concentrated living area. And other things, perform good cleaning with HEPA filter vacuums. For the above reasons, I think it's urgent that the Senate bill is actively supported and even expanded, as I said, to create effective and responsible demolition procedures. I guess from a personal note, it's because I'd like to be able to look at each member of this committee and give an unequivocal yes to that mother who asked, is it safe for my kids to go out and play? That's really my wish. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This really strikes a nerve for what's happening in North and Northeast Portland.
I know it would from your...
My spouse is a nurse practitioner, used to be the medical director of the Josiah Hill Clinic, which had done lead pokes for kids all around North and Northeast Portland. And it always struck me as crazy that we had to have a nonprofit go go out and do lead pokes in the community for kids when it seemed to me it should be part of primary care protocols. And that wasn't offered to our daughter when she hit a particular age, and you had to ask for it. And I was wondering why lead pokes aren't a normal part of primary care protocols. And then I saw how much insurance companies reimbursed for lead pokes, and I think it was $1.30.
Okay.
And I thought that might have something to do with it. But I think this is something that it's very important that you brought some attention around, and I'd like to see us figure out a way to amplify this and go forward. And I will definitely spread the word to, I know some people doing demolition in North and Northeast Portland that might not even be using these protocols, and I'll help spread that word too.
Thank you.
Let's finish the panel.
Thank you very much to all of you on the committee and for giving us the opportunity to come here today. And Senator Shields, Josiah Hill was a friend of mine. And
say your name first.
Oh, sorry. My name is Sharon Genasi. I live in Northwest Portland. I've been the air quality chair there for really about 25 years. But I worked with him, actually. We worked with his protocol in our section of Portland because we had lead exposure from a foundry there. And so I'm very familiar with his work and how important it is, and we have the same problem in our neighborhood too. I'm here today as the chair of the Northwest District Association Air Quality Committee, but I'm testifying on behalf of UNR, United Neighbors for Reform, about asbestos and lead emissions in unregulated demolitions. Based on our research, Oregon's legislature has jurisdictional authority to create hazmat policies for house demolition sites, including inspecting, monitoring, and enforcement for asbestos and lead. And this is where I agree with what you were saying about the we support this bill, but with great reservations, because we're way past the need to study asbestos and lead. I mean, this is just a no-brainer. We're at the point now where we need regulations. We need to have someone there who is certified to deal with asbestos and these sorts of things at the demolition site. We need enforcement, and we need regulations. A survey by the National Association of Clean Air Agencies, the NCAA, wrote in December 4, 2014, the Clean Air Act explicitly allows state and local air pollution control agencies to adopt programs more stringent than those of the federal government. Specifically, Section 1216 states that air quality agencies are not precluded from adopting or enforcing any standards, limitations, or requirements as long as they are at least as stringent as those required under the federal program. Over the past 3 years, Portland has issued 752 demolition permits. The actual number of demolitions is much higher. Unregulated demolitions occur throughout Portland neighborhoods. Neighbors living near the demolitions are increasingly alarmed at asbestos and lead emissions. The question is, who's looking after public health from unregulated demolitions in Portland? Oregon's Lane County, other Oregon cities, and the Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington have adopted rules for asbestos-containing materials and lead-based paint and demolitions. And I've included there a list of the Lane County regulations and asbestos demolition guidance from the Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington. Developers currently profiting from demolitions should pay a fee for accredited inspectors to ensure that all regulations are followed. Public health costs should be a consideration in setting the fees. I attended a memorial in London 2 years ago for a dear friend, a fine architect known for his work on the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. He died of mesothelioma from exposure to asbestos. He was exposed during the interior demolition of a house he was remodeling for himself about 35 years ago. He was at the top of his career, took excellent care of himself, and was well-loved by friends. If demolitions are properly monitored and the air toxics abated, all of us, developers, workers, and neighbors will benefit. And we haven't mentioned the people picking up the refuse from these demolitions. What's happening to them? You know, this is big, and it's
not just to be studied further. Mm-hmm. I've had that for 25 years from the DEQ, and I don't want to hear it anymore.
Well, you know, this bill, my vice chair and I were talking, and, you know, this, I agree, a study isn't going to do it. If it's a study, it means, you know, just a review of the current literature, and, of course, then...
Put it on the back burner.
Yeah, put it on the back burner. But if a study means more extensive and customized work that is outside the scope of the agency's resource or expertise, then OHA may need additional staffing and funding to conduct the study.
And that's the fee.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, I guess the point that... I apologize, sir, I've forgotten your name.
John.
John made... about the fact that these regulations already apply to something as simple as taking down a door, I'm a little puzzled as to why we can't just do some... I mean, believe me, I'm not about dramatic increases in regulation, but this is a huge public health issue, and I was completely unaware until this bill came forward that whole house demolitions didn't have the same restrictions. I lived in an old neighborhood in Portland, and when people would have to move out of their homes when they were trying to get remodels done because they had to strip all the red lead paint out, and that was nothing compared to tearing down the whole house.
Right.
I'm just really baffled. I guess I'd be sort of interested in talking to folks at Building Codes and the Construction Contractors Board about how to deal with this.
Senator Cruz.
Portland has jurisdiction over this. It's in building codes. It's in all of the things that they have jurisdiction over, and I think that, you know, doing something at the state level is one thing, but I think you should task the city of Portland.
We are definitely tasking, but our concerns about demolition are statewide. Any house demolition, especially in a urban environment.
Well, the way the bill's written, it basically applies to Portland.
No, 500 people per. What does it say? 500 people per square mile. So
yeah. I would suggest that that I'm not sure that OHA is the right place to go with this, because you're right, what are they going to discover that is already not known? It should be in the city of Portland or the city of Eugene or whoever who oversees the activities you're talking about. The state doesn't. Okay.
I understand your comments. I still might disagree and say it is a statewide problem, obviously focused in the cities. And the cities do have responsibility to address this, and we are working with the Portland people.
I guess not. My point is, the cities have the jurisdiction.
Well, I would think maybe I'm trying to think of the public health authority of each county. I mean, the counties have their public health. This is a public health issue, and I'm trying to figure out who should be the one, but someone should be developing a strategic plan on how to deal with the public health hazard that occurs when you're demolishing.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
In the interest of time, we have a bill before us that I think makes some sense. Do we have to send this to Ways and Means?
Well, I think this committee feels it needs to be more than a study, so it would have to go to Ways and Means.
Well, if we send it to Ways and Means without a significant, it's even scheduled for work.
We have work session, we have paperwork, but is DEQ here? Can you come out up here? Give us your 2 cents worth.
So you're suggesting perhaps amending the bill to actually do something more than study?
To do something, but so maybe we will not move it today, and we need to talk to the Senator Dembro too.
Sponsor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Davis. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm the Western Region Air Quality Manager, and I'm also the Asbestos Program Manager. I'm not prepared to give testimony. I wasn't expecting to do that. So I thought I was just going to be here to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, I guess what we were thinking is we're trying to see if we could come up with a strategic plan to address the demolition rather than just having a study done, and something that would have more teeth in it, because these demolitions are happening all over, and I was just wondering what, from DEQ's point of view, I mean, could maybe Senator Dembro work with you on?
I'm not sure this is just DEQ, though.
It isn't just DEQ.
Excuse me, but if I can, that is the problem. It's all of the ones I stated have a little piece of the pie.
Public health,
none of them
DEQ.
Put a total puzzle together to address, in my opinion, to address the real potential risk to the public.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, United States Environmental Protection Agency promulgated something called a National Emission Standard for Hazardous Air Pollutants for Asbestos. DEQ adopted those rules in 2001, and it requires, and we just adopted their rules as written, essentially. It requires asbestos surveys be performed before any demolition or renovation activities, but it excludes residents or residential units with four or more living units from the survey requirement. When we adopted the NESHAP, we did a rulemaking. We attempted to include a survey requirement for residences, and due to opposition during the rulemaking process, that was dropped.
Who opposed?
I wasn't in the
Anybody
asbestos
in the demolition
program.
Business?
Developers, right?
I don't know. I was not in the asbestos program or a manager at that time, so I don't know who was involved. Okay. But I understand that there was significant concern from several different industry groups.
Of course.
Right, and that's my concern is that, okay, so if we delayed this bill and then all of a sudden amend it, we're going to have this room packed full of people who are going to try to kill the bill. So we might want to just pass the bill, move it along as is.
But it doesn't do anything. That's their problem.
Madam Chair, not only that, but you're asking one agency to step into a universe that another agency has experience and history with, and so I think if you're going to do modification, it should be with the folks that already have the program.
This is a problem we have here in Oregon. The agency who is tasked with regulating the airshed here and contracted to do this job and has this in their mission statement is the DEQ. They're tasked to do this by the EPA. The problem is, and they often we go round and round on this because they're not staffed enough to do it, or they're whatever. But it's not happening. So everybody's washing their hands of these really serious air quality problems here.
So what we should do is pass a bill that puts residential homes into the statute that was taken out, and then have a fee, which everybody's going to oppose.
Yes.
But I think we need to, let's talk to the chief sponsor of the bill and see if they
can. I do think putting it in the right agency is an appropriate move.
So the health authority, which is where this is going right now, makes a certain amount of sense, because this is the task force. If we're going to do this as a task force, sending it there. But if we're going to do this, I would want to change the charge of the task force, because the charge of the task force is what's already been done.
Right.
The bigger issue is how do we do this when it's under multiple agency jurisdictions? But if it sounds as if mitigation rules are already in place for remodels, who controls those? Is it that all city code or county code?
When I talked about remodeling, that was strictly the lead-based paint. So we're dealing with two different. The OHA focuses on the lead-based paint. That's the renovation, repair, and painting issues.
I had my house remodeled, and it had asbestos. And so we had to move out, and they removed the asbestos. So at least my contractor knew how to deal with it.
Yeah,
that was asbestos. A remodel.
But in a remodel.
No, but
that wasn't lead.
Again, asbestos and lead-based paint are dealt with two different agencies and two different sets of rulings.
Okay.
So there's the problem.
So,
and OSHA gets involved with the workers involved, but not the neighborhoods.
Gotcha.
So the charge for the task force, Madam Chair, is really not what we want it to be. The bigger issue is not what the risks are, because we know what the risks are.
It's coordination.
Who's responsible and how do you coordinate when there are multiple different health hazards and multiple different agencies involved. So if we're going to do this and we're going to do just a task force because we think it's too hard to do anything bigger at this point in session, then we at least have to change the charge of the task force to make it that we develop a coordinated plan for issues like this that are involve multiple agencies.
I agree. Okay.
And there needs to be some enforcement.
Yes.
We
so,
understand.
We get it. We're going to talk with the carrier. Thank you so much for coming, and the bill's not dead yet.
Madam Chair, can I add something?
Yes.
I know the Senate bill talks about asbestos and insulation. I want to make sure the committee understands that asbestos is present in lots of other products and homes and businesses. It's not just an insulation. In fact, probably popcorn ceiling and acoustical
floor tile and vinyl flooring
is more common and more usually found. Asbestos was used in building products through the 1900, the entire century, extensively. The use stopped, decreased significantly in the 1970s, but there are still products produced today that have asbestos in them.
Yeah, I agree. It was floor tile in our house. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 70.